Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Winebanks and me, Joyce Vance. Barb and Kim are out this week, but we are fortunate to be joined by our good friend, MSNBC host and legal analyst Katie Fang. Many of you already know Katie. She's a former prosecutor from Florida and the host of The Katie Fang Show on MSNBC. Katie, thanks for joining us today.
It's my honor. I'm so happy to be here. It's my maiden voyage on Hashtag Sisters-in-Law, although I feel like you guys have spoiled me rotten, all of you, by giving me the privilege of your time on my show. So I appreciate all of you as always.
Thank you for being here.
You're absolutely a sister-in-law. And, you know, Kim and Barb will be back soon, folks. So don't give up. We're missing them already, but we are glad to have Katie with us for today because we have a lot of important issues to discuss. We'll start with Judge Aileen Cannon's shocking decision to dismiss the classified documents case in Florida. We'll talk about what will happen in the special counsel's election interference prosecution in the District of Columbia once Judge Chutkan is able to proceed in that case. And we'll continue our conversation about Project 2025. We've promised you that we'll take up one small bite of that every week, just to give us a mouthful so that we can think about the whole Project 2025 is so long, it's tough to do it in one. We're going to do it in pieces here. So before we get started on the serious stuff, we had a great question from one of our listeners on Twitter. And instead of saving it for the end of the show like we usually do, I thought I'd tee it up with y'all now. This comes from Lil G on Twitter, and she asks, she said, I wanted a lighter question given the kind of week it's been. So she asked, if you weren't a lawyer, what would your dream job be? Katie?
Okay, so that one, so I struggled with this more so than maybe any of the legal analysis that we do. Because I'm like, do I give some highbrow answer where maybe it should be reflective of some type of, you know, kind of aspirational thing, or am I just really blunt? And I think, well, I'm not a lawyer anymore, so I am doing part of my dream, which is being on TV and having a show, etc. But I do think if I wasn't being a lawyer, I'd like to be a buyer for a store. And I would love that to be able to travel with a purpose. I mean, I don't have enough time to travel generally, but I would love to be able to travel with a purpose. So my cousin, before she launched these amazing restaurants in New York City, used to be the head crystal buyer for Tiffany and Company, for Tiffany's. So she'd travel all over the world and she would buy crystal for the company. I'd love to be the buyer for a store. Now, I'm not specific, like you wouldn't have to hold me to something specifically of what I'd be buying, but I think Jill would probably appreciate this job because she loves to buy and travel. But I'd love to be able to go and travel with a purpose to another country, to be able to visit other cultures and to be able to bring something back to the United States, to be able to sell or show in some way. So you can kind of take a piece of another country or a culture or a community and bring it back for other people to see. Like I love traveling exhibitions and museums and such. And so I would love to be able to do something like that.
Jill, I'm seeing you just light up as Katie discusses that. What's your answer?
For sure. Well, first of all, I agree with everything that Katie said. And I have, of course, as all of our listeners know, had almost every job conceivable from working for a CIA front to, you know, doing international business development, which was the most amazing job where I got to travel all over to really interesting places and to really get to know the culture and to negotiate the same deals, but in totally different ways because of different cultures. And I love foreign travel, always have. And my undergraduate degree is journalism. So this is like being a dream job of being able to combine being a lawyer and being a journalist. I love it. But I would say that my real thing that I'd like to be, and for which I have absolutely zero talent, I want to be Bette Midler. I would love to be Bette Midler. I want to walk like she walks. I want to sing like she sings. I want to act like she acts. I love her. So that's what I'd like to be.
Well, Bette, if you're listening to the podcast, it sounds like you and Jill need to get together for an afternoon, and I want to get to be a fly for that. You know, I sort of love the current gig I have as a lawyer in recovery, podcasting, being a legal analyst for MSNBC, teaching bright young law students, and getting to write my newsletter. It feels like a full plate as I say all of that out loud, but it really is pretty fun. But I'll tell you, as much as I love to travel, I'm going to disclose my inner nerd and say that if I could just have my dream job, I think it would be to have a small knitting store that also had a really good espresso bar in it and maybe like a little plant store corner, maybe a little bit of a bakery, and just to sit there and make people happy all day. I think
and
that would
animals,
be fun.
I know,
I
would be their choice.
It better be animal friendly, right? Yeah.
You know, have you ever been to those cat cafes where you go in and you can pet a cat or take your dog along? That would absolutely be my gig. There would be iguanas. There might be chickens outdoors. They could get a little bit messy indoors. But yeah, all the animals too. So y'all come on down.
I'll go buying for your store. I'll go find tchotchkes for your store.
So let's get right to it and start with the first thing we want to talk about. And I just want to have a conversation and hear both of your views on Judge Cannon stopping the prosecution of Trump in Florida. The Mar-a-Lago documents case is dead. She dismissed the case, and now it's being appealed. That has already been approved. So first of all, let's talk about, Joyce, why don't you tell us what the basis for her ruling was?
So the technical basis for the ruling is that it was unconstitutional to appoint Jack Smith as the special counsel. Because his appointment was unconstitutional, the indictment is invalid and the whole thing has to go away. I mean, I think that's the simple way of saying it, right, Katie?
Yeah, I'd say to drill down a little bit, though, it's the absence of a statute specifically that would permit the appointment of special counsel Jack Smith. I think that's kind of the more kind of specific response to Jill's inquiry. But you are right. It's an unconstitutional appointment, and therefore it invalidates the entire indictment and the superseding indictment, frankly, the one that came after the original indictment.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's important to note that it is the absence of a statute, because there are other appointments of a special counsel that probably would have been okay under Judge Cannon's ruling. If you had appointed someone who was already a United States attorney, so that they'd been presidentially appointed and Senate confirmed, and we know that there are a couple of those floating around, like the one who is prosecuting Hunter Biden, that probably would pass muster under her analysis, but not Jack Smith, who was brought back in from the outside.
Although I will point out that there are at least two statutes that give the Attorney General the power to appoint special counsel. And Neil Katyal just did a piece that I will put in our show notes that lays out a very clear explanation of why her opinion is nonsense. He ends his case or his opinion piece with a question about whether Jack Smith will, in addition to appealing this, also ask for her dismissal. And my answer is he certainly should, and that three strikes you're out. She's already been reversed twice, and I think the third time should do it. But I'd like to hear what you both think, especially because her opinion completely ignores precedent. Eight prior times, the courts have said, of course it's okay to have a special counsel. And that's what she totally ignored. What do you all think about that?
Okay. Well, I will say just kind of high level, I've been to almost all of the hearings in front of Judge Cannon in Fort Pierce. It's been a schlep to go from Miami to go. And when I've gone, it's been very long. Hearings have taken place that normally would not otherwise have taken place, but for the fact that it was in front of Judge Cannon. The reason why I say this is it's a 93-page ruling. It's an order on a motion to dismiss. And what frustrates me, among other things, is the fact that this order was written in July. It came out July 15th, but we all know she had to have had it in the hopper for a while, right? Because 93 pages is not generated overnight. And let's actually talk about how the sausage is really made. She didn't sit down and draft a 93-page opinion herself or ruling herself. She had law clerks working on it. I mean, it's not like she just woke up and said, here, I'm going to choose injustice this morning. And so I'm frustrated because this motion to dismiss was filed in February of 2024, which was five plus months ago.
Yes.
And it could have been heard straight out of the gate. If she was going to have oral arguments on it, she should have had it a long time ago. And that would have given more of a runway for Jack Smith to be able to seek some type of appellate review if this was what she was going to do. But I attended the oral arguments on this motion to dismiss based on appointments clause and also on the violation of the appropriations clause. And it didn't seem like it was going to go this way in terms of her granting the motion to dismiss. And that's kind of the fake out that she gives you, because during oral arguments, she'll make it seem like she's veering one way, and then she'll issue a written order that goes the opposite direction. And that's incredibly frustrating because, you don't always read tea leaves based on oral arguments, but sometimes you really can. I mean, the three of us have been in court arguing over decades of time in front of different judges in different jurisdictions, and it usually is some indicator of where a judge is leaning based upon the questions that are posed. I've heard some really, I think, thoughtful criticisms about this opinion or ruling, I guess, which is she looks at it from an appellate court standpoint and not from a trial judge standpoint, because that's kind of where she cut her teeth as a federal prosecutor is, through appellate work. And I feel like she's looking at it that way, putting aside what she's getting wrong, because it's kind of ironic then if she's looking at it from an appellate standpoint, you think she'd have respect for precedent, to Jill's point.
Yeah.
You think she'd have respect for the idea that other circuits higher than her have, gone through this and tackled this issue and they've come to the proper conclusion, and she just ignores that wholesale. And she makes a big kind of, she makes a lot of hay over saying that this decision is specific to her case only. Yeah. So it's almost like she's saying, yeah, I know there's precedent. Yeah, I recognize it exists, but you know what? To hell with it. I'm just going to do whatever I want to do because this is my fiefdom. And that really troubles me because as both you, Jill, and especially Joyce right now, as you teach, I was an adjunct professor for a while as well. You're teaching law students this concept of precedent, and then it kind of gets ignored by her wholesale, as we've seen her being reversed by the 11th.
And so, and I just the Supreme Court, that, right?
Yeah.
Tough
and I kind of just want to put that
school.
Out there. Yeah. So that's kind of just a little bit of a high level kind of thought I had, Jill, about this.
So, yeah, I want to just ask a follow up, and maybe Joyce, because you did so much appellate work. But Katie, because you were in the courtroom, I'm sure you can weigh in on this, was how unusual this hearing was because it wasn't just the parties arguing. And while amicus briefs are not unusual, having them actually argue in the courtroom is highly unusual. So what was it like being there, Katie?
So it was unusual. We have overuse of adjectives these days, right? Since 2016, but it was so unusual because I feel like she wanted, even though there's no cameras or videos in the courtroom in federal court, right? I feel like she wanted the American public to almost hear the justification of what she was going to do with it, right? It's like, let me bring in two lawyers that wrote amicus briefs or amicus, and let me let them argue on behalf of Donald Trump's position. And then this exceptional lawyer named Matthew Seligman came in to argue on behalf of special counsel Jack Smith. And I had him on my show a few weeks ago, and he was like, this was a bizarre experience for me to have to go, to be arguing in front of a district court judge on an amicus brief when normally that wouldn't happen. And to have that happen, one of the lawyers that argued on behalf of one of these amicus briefs, she kind of hurried through his argument, right? She was like, oh, okay, got it, whatever. But it just kind of was frustrating to allow that type of oxygen to be given in this situation. And I don't think that's the right type of precedent to be setting, frankly, because then she kind of cherry picked who and how people could be heard on these briefs, which is what made it even more, I think, frustrating to have to sit through.
I'll just add two things because I think Katie hits all the key points. I mean, one thing is the irony of an appellate lawyer who should understand precedent refusing to ignore all precedent. And she does make a point that I think is legitimate. She says, there is no binding case law in the circuit. That's right. This is an issue of first impression in the 11th Circuit. But other circuits have considered this. It's a unique sort of issue. And the fact that she just ignores that precedent without really doing a good job of explaining why it's wrong and doesn't apply here, I think that that's troubling. And then there's the precedent she chooses to follow. That is a one justice concurrence in the Supreme Court's immunity decision written by Justice Thomas, who writes to an issue that has not been raised in the immunity case, not briefed, not fully argued. And he concludes out of the blue that the appointment of the special counsel isn't constitutional. She picks up on that and carries it forward. So look, you don't have to know a lot about the law to understand that when one justice can't attract any additional support for an opinion, it is not the law. She treats it like it is. And I don't want to jinx the rule of law and say it's not the law because, Maybe Justice Thomas could have picked up more support for his view if it had been an issue that was properly before the court. You don't really know what might happen when it surfaces in front of the Supreme Court again. But at least for here, I think it was the sort of thing that if one of my law students had answered a question on an exam with this sort of an analysis, it would have been tough to give them a pass. And then there's the question that you flagged, Jill, of recusal. Should she be removed from the case? I want to be clear about something. Recusal is something that does not happen very often. We don't get to remove judges because we don't like their decisions, right? When you're a lawyer, like half the time, one person on every side of the case is not going to like the judge's ruling. They might vehemently disagree with it. They might think it's wrong. That's not grounds for a recusal. The primary way judges get recused is because they have a conflict of interest. And that's not the case here. Some people have suggested that because she was appointed by President Trump, she should have recused. But look, you know, every federal judge in the country is appointed by a president from one party or the other. Lots of Trump judges have sat on cases where Trump was involved. Absent more than that, I just have a tough time thinking that the 11th Circuit would order her recused on a conflict basis. But what there is here is a track record, and it's a bad one. She's the judge who was assigned to this crazy civil case after the search warrant was executed at Mar-a-Lago. Donald Trump did something that the law doesn't authorize. He filed a civil lawsuit asking that the government not be permitted to use its evidence. And instead of just dismissing it like she should have, Aileen Cannon entertained it, brought on board a special master, delayed the government's investigation by months until the case got in front of the 11th Circuit. And they were not polite. And this is a circuit where the judges bend over backwards to be collegial. You know, in oral argument, you refer, and you hear this in the Supreme Court too, but we are serious about it in the 11th Circuit. You talk about your brother or sister counsel. It's just such a polite process, even when people disagree. The 11th Circuit wasn't really polite. They essentially said, you didn't have jurisdiction to go on this fishing expedition, and you're done here. It was really one of the plainest opinions I've ever seen. And so in the 11th Circuit, there is some case law that suggests that when a judge has been reversed more than once on appeal, she was reversed twice in the course of those proceedings, that they may just have difficulty setting aside their previous views. And it might be better to reassign the case on remand. And I know that decision, that body of law in the 11th Circuit pretty well, because I argued one of the key cases there, United States versus Martin, that involved a federal judge who was having some difficulty sentencing a defendant in the way the Court of Appeals thought he needed to be sentenced under the law. And so that sort of rubric exists in our circuit for removing judges. In Martin, interestingly, Jill, I actually didn't ask the court to recuse the judge. They did it on their own. We call it sua sponte. A couple of other cases in that line, I did ask for remand. And I'll tell you one last interesting detail. I was not the United States attorney when this happened. I was a lawyer in our appellate division handling these cases. Well, little Joyce Vance in Birmingham can't just decide she's going to appeal. You have to go to the Solicitor General for permission to do that. The lawyer who was the Deputy Solicitor General for criminal at that point in time, where I got the approval to go ahead and appeal multiple times in situations where there were recusals, was a lawyer named Michael Dreeben. Michael Dreeben is currently the appellate lawyer for the special counsel, and I have a suspicion he remembers this body of case law pretty well.
Excellent. I want to get to two quick questions before we go to another topic, but it's already been mentioned that this was a 93-page decision that didn't get written overnight, but was released just before the Republican convention started. And Joyce, you and I have disagreed about the political timing of things at the Supreme Court.
No, that's Kim. That's not me, girl.
Well, so you agree with me that they are releasing politically
I'm
timed.
In between the two of y'all. I don't think that they're overtly political, but you know, I have begun to question some of the motivation for what happens.
And what do you think about this timing? Katie, what do you think? Joyce, what do you think?
I think it was intentionally timed. Again, we had oral arguments a few weeks ago on this, putting aside my criticism that, and I just wanted to footnote my criticism. When you are attacking the appointment of the prosecutor on the case, it should be disposed of at the beginning, because there's been a lot of hearings and a lot of work and a lot of time spent, including me driving to Fort Pierce on this case. And there's been a lot of drama over the CIPA issues, the Classified Information Procedures Act issues. There's been a lot of issues, and this should have been dealt with at the beginning, ab initio, right? At the very beginning, and put this issue to bed and let it travel the way it needs to travel to be ultimately disposed of. So my criticism is, you didn't have to issue it when you did you, Eileen Cannon? You could have sat on it after Milwaukee. You didn't have to put it out right before. And I find that to be a big tell. I lean, no pun intended, towards what Joyce says about the recusal issue. And by the way, it's Eileen.
Is it Eileen?
I thought it was Aileen.
Thank you so much for clarifying that.
Thank you. How do you say amicus? Amicus or amicus?
I say amicus, but then this Matt Sullivan guy was like amicus. And I was like, damn, I must be saying, tomato, tomato wrong. But I was in court, and the clerk for her announcing the judge entering the courtroom said, the Honorable Eileen Cannon now presiding.
Oh,
so we
thank
all took
you.
Note of that. But this was a big tell, I think. And I militate towards what Joyce says. I don't know if we're at the level of straight recusal of Judge Cannon at this point. I think a colorable argument could be made, but I do find stuff like this to be just distasteful. If it's not recusable, quote unquote, I just find it to be distasteful.
I think that's dead on the money. This isn't nine justices, where you have some reasonable belief that there are forces that are preventing political timing. This is one judge dropping something that it took her 5 months to decide, with just perfect from central casting timing for political purposes. There is no way that you can read benign intent into that, because if she had been in any way thoughtful, that's not the timing for this decision to come down. So I can only conclude that it was deliberate.
It was one of the first things that Donald Trump said in his acceptance speech about the dismissal. So I think it was definitely politically timed.
Well, from Florida and on to the District of Columbia, because Judge Chutkan is about to regain her ability to proceed after the Supreme Court's decision on presidential immunity. Jill, it has been a minute, so why don't you start with a quick refresher? This case has been on hold while the immunity issue was on appeal. Now the Supreme Court has made its decision. What needs to happen before Judge Chutkan can proceed?
It's correct. It's been on hold, and Judge Chutkan had promised that any time lost because of the appeal would be added on for preparation. So even after everything is resolved, and let me get into how long that might take, there's 82 more days for trial preparation. Right now, the Supreme Court has to issue the mandate and send it back on remand to Judge Chutkan. And that usually takes about 25 days, which is almost up. And then there's another week added on to that. So you can assume that it may not be until at least the end of next week before the mandate issues, at which point Judge Chutkan has to decide if she's going to have a hearing to determine what things are in the core responsibilities and absolutely immune from prosecution, which are presumptively immune in that official but maybe not core responsibilities, and which are absolutely unofficial personal acts and not immune. Everybody has been hoping and thinking that there would be a hearing at which evidence would come forward, because there's no way this will go to trial before the election. It's theoretically possible, but so highly unlikely that at least this is one way the American public might get to hear what the evidence on each of these counts is. And I think that's a value added. Of course, if cameras were in the courtroom, as Katie has alluded to, it would be even that much better, because seeing is way better than reading or hearing a reporter's report, no matter how good they are, including Katie Fang, who's one of the best in reporting what happens in a courtroom. It's not the same as seeing it. So I would like to see a camera.
Katie, to Jill's point, there's lots of speculation about what will happen next. But there's also been a lot of talk about holding evidentiary hearings that are being characterized as mini trials. Can you help us understand what that's about?
Sure. So the Supreme Court opinion makes it clear that there is a lack of fact-finding that was conducted prior to the case making it to the Supreme Court. And that lack of fact-finding requires Judge Tanya Chutkan, as the trial court judge, to now conduct some kind of hearing to be able to make the decision that Jill, you know, very astutely pointed out. What bucket does that act fall within? And in order to make that determination, the Supreme Court says, why don't you, Judge Chutkan, make that determination after the facts are presented? So to Jill's point, how are those facts presented? There has been some argument that perhaps the facts would be presented by way of just a legal filing, but that's not sufficient. When you need to be able to make a decision as a fact finder, you need evidence. An argument in a legal brief is not evidence. I don't care if you slap a jurata, an oath on it or not, an affidavit, without the ability to cross-examine the affiant, the person who's swearing out that affidavit, it renders it just kind of a nullity, right? I mean, you don't have the opportunity to test the validity and the credibility of that witness and the information that they're providing. And so because of that, I, along with several others, believe that these mini trials or these evidentiary hearings will have to be conducted to facilitate Judge Chutkan being able to decide into which of the three buckets she's going to be able to place the acts that have currently been alleged in Special Counsel Jack Smith's indictment in D.C. One of the interesting kind of challenges I think that may arise, and our good friend Hugo Lowell at The Guardian and I have noodled this a lot, is the idea that challenges will be raised when it comes to the speech and debate clause and executive privilege and things like that, wherein people who you would think you would need to hear from, like the Mike Pence, the Mark Meadows, and the others of the world, that they will actually throw up obstacles that would create all this litigation and argument that have to be resolved before Chutkan would be able to move forward. I think a lot of that has already been resolved. The luxury we get from Judge Chutkan is her appellate circuit court is the D.C. Circuit, and that D.C. Circuit was very busy prior to any of these indictments coming forth against Donald Trump to resolve several of these issues when it came to decisions as to whether or not certain witnesses must, for example, testify in front of grand juries. But even grand jury testimony could be subject to confidentiality objections, et cetera. And so I think the goal is to make it as public as possible, whether it's by way of journalists to get the information out to the American public. But I think Chutkan can ignore the drama from Judge Cannon, because there's also been this issue, will the special counsel appointment issue be raised in front of Chutkan to try to stop those evidentiary hearings from moving forward? But the D.C. Circuit's already disposed of that issue. And I think Chutkan is known for her efficiency. And I think that these evidentiary hearings will come fast and furious. And I think they'll happen before November.
Can I add something to that, which is you refer to grand jury secrecy, which is a very major tenet of our judicial system. But there is a rule that allows the prosecutor to go to a court and ask for permission to share that for certain reasons. That's what we did in Watergate, where we got permission to give grand jury testimony to the House Judiciary Committee holding impeachment hearings. And so that is something that would be another option, and it is D.C. Circuit precedent. So it would be pretty compelling that at least that would be able to be put forward.
You know, that is an utterly fascinating point, Jill, that I had not considered or thought about. And that would be very interesting if prosecutors tried to do that. Katie, I think, makes out an interesting case for how Trump's lawyers might try to prevent these mini trials, prevent any evidence from being made public. What do you think about it? Will Trump be able to succeed in slowing this down? I mean, given who all the players are and where this sort of a request by Trump would ultimately land?
He will be less successful in front of Chutkan and the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals than he has been in Florida before Judge Eileen Cannon and the
but that's not where this is going to go, right? I mean, you can just smell shadow docket here.
Of course. It's going to go to the Supreme Court, inevitably. And we've seen the precedent that they have established for delay, delay, delay. And they don't even come back till the first Monday in October. So you're done until then. And that's why it does raise a question of whether this could get to trial. I mean, theoretically, it can. But if they take it in October, they can easily hold it till November. So yes, that's what I think is going to happen. I don't think that in a normal world, in a normal Supreme Court, that this would be successful, that the weight of the decisions in the past would be in favor of proceeding with this. Everything since Watergate, where the court said, no, executive privilege does not prevent him from complying with a lawful subpoena in a criminal case. He has to do that. And the same would be true for testimony.
A normal Supreme Court would wing in from summer vacation and say, no, no, go back and proceed with the hearings that we ordered in our opinion. But I fear that you're right. Let's talk, I mean, that's procedure. Let's talk substance a little bit. Based on the Supreme Court's decision in the immunity opinion, these three buckets that we've talked about, official conduct near the outer perimeter, and unofficial conduct, what's left for Jack Smith? I mean, Katie, what do you think, what are the charges that Smith can still bring?
So I think to answer that question, we have to remind everybody that the big problem that arises for somebody for like Jack Smith out of this immunity opinion is the inability to use official act evidence in any capacity. So I think we heard through the oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court this idea that you create a one-legged stool. So how do you functionally move forward as a prosecutor with a one-legged stool case? And I think there's a few phrases kind of peppered throughout the immunity opinion that perhaps could provide a little bit of grace to Jack Smith to allow for that type of evidence to be used in terms of, quote, context. There's actual language that suggests that in order to make decisions, for example, when it comes to Donald Trump's statements that he made in the weeks leading up to January 6th and on January 6th in that particular section of the immunity opinion, there is a discussion of how Trump's conduct and other conduct, but more specifically Trump, right, could be used to provide context, and maybe his official act conduct could be used to provide context for those statements. I will give people some hope, though. I mean, the immunity is a one-way street for a president, right? And so if it's other people, though, and this is kind of, Joyce, I think you and I had kind of noodled this a little bit. If official acts are immune, could you still, though, develop, if you're Jack Smith, a case to be able to prosecute your charges with the third party conduct, which is not president's conduct? And I'm trying to be as exact as I can. But if there are third party actors that are outside the DOJ, fake electors, for example, and others, you can and you should be able to use their conduct, their speech, their admissions to be able to build your case if you're Jack Smith. And so I feel like the charges remain intact in D.C. for that federal election interference case. I just think some of the charges are stronger now if you're looking at the three bucket analysis, and those are going to be kind of built more on the evidence that's the fake elector scheme and the people that are outside of DOJ and others that are outside of the executive branch.
You know, I keep fighting the question, or maybe in this case, fighting the holding. I, you know, none of us like the immunity decision because we don't like where it leads. As a prosecutor, it really bothers me for a reason that you flagged, Katie. As a prosecutor, you can always put in evidence of what we call res gestae, the story of the crime, right? You have to give juries context so they can understand the evidence. This immunity decision seems to revoke that, which has been very troubling to me, and I like your analysis. Jill, what's the key evidence that you see the government losing the ability to present, and what can they still get in?
So before that, I want to weigh in on what you both have just said, which is this could lead to a superseding indictment with co-conspirators identified, because in order to introduce their testimony or their acts, if they're co-conspirators, there's no question. And so I think that might be something that could help to proceed, although I think Jack Smith was smart in the beginning to say, this is a case against Donald Trump. I'm not going to have all these other people in there that will lead to delays that are unnecessary.
But wait, can I ask you about that? Because three of the four counts are conspiracy counts in the original indictment. So do you think, does the case become stronger if they supersede and add in specific additional co-defendants?
I think it could be. And I think that is, I mean, at this point, because of taking away some of the evidence, and specifically to answer your question, for example, the court made it clear that conversations with his attorney general and other people at Justice, even if it was to commit a crime, even if it showed that you can't even look at his motive for having those conversations, which I find to be...
It's crazy.
I was trying to think of a nice way of saying crazy is good enough. Yes, it's totally crazy. It's insane. And it's totally wrong. And I'm hoping that there's some way that something can be done to undo that before we have to have another case of this magnitude to overturn that decision when there's a new Supreme Court. It's horrible to say you cannot prosecute crimes that are clearly crimes and that are clearly motivated by a bad intent that have nothing to do with your official jobs. So you lose the DOJ conversations. To me, that also means you probably lose his conversations with his vice president, but maybe not. I think you probably do. You don't lose his conversations with state officials because he had no official responsibility for elections in the states. And that is a state function. So all of those cases that are built on that, the fake slate of electors, that is something that I think remains. The attempt to get 11,900 more votes in Georgia, that's the same thing. But then you get into, you know, all the things that happened in Congress that he was attempting to use the violence. You know, he's going to say, well, that was my job to make sure that I'm not sure what he'll argue, and I don't want to suggest anything to him.
It was my job to incite violence in the Congress.
Right. Yeah. it's hard to imagine, but I think there's still a lot left, and that there are pieces of evidence from other people that would be okay. I think the precedent on executive privilege would not allow the barring of some of that. I think executive privilege only applies to him. And I mean, he can invoke it for the conversations he had, but there were plenty of other conversations between other people. And we have text messages and other things that are evidence. I think there's a lot to go forward with, but I don't think it's that easy to parse the three buckets. Some that I think are so clearly personal, I know he will argue are not, that he was in office and therefore it's immune. That's a ridiculous concept.
I would just add a little bit of a wrinkle that's not a positive one. As we know, there's several states that are prosecuting the fake elector schemes. And so you may be confronted with Fifth Amendment self-incrimination issues from some of the players that would be critical for Jack Smith. And so we kind of have to keep that in mind. The silver lining, though, because there are several cases being prosecuted, there's evidence that's going to come in from those cases that Jack Smith could use in his case. Because when you're prosecuting a federal case, you're not just obligated to just use what's in federal land. You can dip into state land if there's evidence there, and you can bootstrap your case. And so I feel like all is not lost. I just think you got to be creative, which is why I'm happy it's Jack Smith, because I think Jack Smith is incredibly well-organized, detailed, and ready to go. I mean, we saw his appeal in Cannon came out, 72 hours, not even, after that ruling from Judge Cannon.
Yeah, so Katie, last question for you, because those state cases could proceed. But of course, there's an election looming over all of our heads. Go vote, y'all. And the question that I have for you is this. Jack Smith has said he will continue to prosecute his cases down to the bitter end, right? Even if Trump wins the election, he said he'll go through Inauguration Day. What do you think that would look like?
It would look like what it always looks like. That's the reality. The reason why Jack can do that is because there's no policy that prohibits an active case from continuing to be prosecuted. It's not like he's going to be indicting Donald Trump on the eve of the November election. And I think that's what people need to be reminded of. We always talk about justice being blind and that there is no man above the law, and which means if you're a criminal defendant, your case number and your jail number is specific to you. And that is why you are being prosecuted. And that would look like it normally does. It would proceed in a regular docket. And that is how justice is supposed to be meted out. It's not supposed to be selective. And he shouldn't get special privileges because he's a candidate for office. He committed a crime and he's being prosecuted. And a jury of his peers will determine his guilt, as we've seen in New York. And I think, you know, because America gets cheated from seeing the finish line sooner on some of his prosecutions, it doesn't mean that things should be put on the back burner because you got an election. And I appreciate the idea that DOJ makes it clear that a pending case is a pending case. It's not one that has to be derailed because somebody decides to run for office, because at that rate, everybody would run for office if they were being prosecuted for a crime.
Yeah, it feels to me like Jack Smith has said, the rule of law is going to go down fighting.
Hopefully it doesn't go down.
Like I said, go vote, y'all.
Well, we promised you that we would talk about at least one part of Project 2025 every week. And this week, I picked the Department of Education and its potential elimination as the topic. As the former officer for career and technical education for the Chicago Public Schools under later Secretary of Education Irene Dunklin.
Whoa, wait a second. Did we know that you had held that job? Is this another new Jill Winebanks job?
Well, no. I mean, if you read my book or my
bio,
you
know I was
there. But I
mean, on the podcast, I don't think you've talked about this one before.
It hasn't been relevant until today, so okay. I kept it a secret.
Keep going.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
So I read chapter 11 with great interest. And Joyce, you wrote about this chapter in your civil discourse about the proposed elimination of DOE. And of course, we will put your Substack on our show notes so that everyone can read your very good insights. And, you know, I was struck because a friend said to me, oh, well, it's not going to affect our suburban schools. And I was shocked and pointed out that it would eliminate Head Start, school meals, funding for career and technical education, which comes largely from the federal government, and many other programs. And it would give block grants to the states to use for religious and private schools or anything else that they want to use it for. It would be the end of public education, which I'm a graduate of public schools, and I believe that it is the best way to get people to know each other and to understand differences in cultures and differences in beliefs. It also, as you point out in your Substack, there's a link to civil rights in what they're posing here and where they're sending things to other departments. And so I want to start with you, Joyce, because you wrote the article. What do you think about what's going on and whether it's a bad thing or as bad as I think it is?
Yeah, I'm going to try to not sneer when I talk. I mean, I'll just tell y'all my background. My mom was a preschool teacher. My mom taught in a President Johnson in one of his great society programs, federally funded education to equalize opportunity for kids from, you know, low-income, one-parent homes. And that school helped so many kids. I mean, I watched my mom teach there for over 20 years, helped so many kids get on a path that might not have been available to them otherwise. So it would take an act of Congress to abolish the Department of Education. But Project 2025 has a workaround for that. Their plan involves dismantling the department so that the only thing that's left is this sort of hollow shell that can do nothing other than gather statistics and disseminate them to the states. And that's the goal for this agency whose current mission, as you say, Jill, is to promote student achievement and preparation for global competitiveness by fostering educational excellence and ensuring equal access. That's what's currently on the Department of Education's website. You know, that sounds like a good thing to me, making young people more competitive in today's worldwide economy. But apparently that is something Project 2025 plans to eliminate. And the context does matter here, right? Why would you want to get rid of national education policy and funding and authority? Sometimes Republicans favor small government, this notion of leaving things to the states. But this isn't a small government priority per se. The education chapter and its author, who is a well-known opponent of federal funding for early childhood education, they give us this not very subtle hint. And that subtle hint is their view that the seeds for what became the Department of Education were planted in 1964, around the time that President Johnson signed into law the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and that it's all about Congress reaching a consensus at that point in time that the mistreatment of Black Americans was no longer tolerable and that it merited a federal response. This chapter of Project 2025 is about undoing that response.
And Katie, do you want to add to anything that Joyce said?
Sure, very quickly. Education is the great equalizer. The ability to access education is the great equalizer. My father came to this country barely speaking English from Korea with $2.43 in his pocket. He spent 5 cents at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, SeaTac, on a Coca-Cola, and then found a place to stay at the local YMCA, but he came to the United States to get an education. Because of what my father was given the chance to do, I was able to live a better life. And because I am a public school graduate, all grades until college, my education was one that was not just dedicated to books in textbooks. It was being able to be in a school with kids from different backgrounds and communities and socioeconomic backgrounds, et cetera. And I think if you put a price tag on education and you make it so that it's only accessible by an elite and select few, to Joyce's point, you're making it so that there is the haves and the have-nots to such a gradient and such a degree of severity that you are intentionally oppressing other people, but you're using as a cudgel in education. You're using somebody's brain as that. And I couldn't find something that's more offensive, because people still use the idea of education as an excuse or a justification for jobs. You know, they say you have to have a certain level of education, or you have to have a certain level of schooling to be able to access certain worlds. And I think that is that true separatism that they're seeking. And I think it is racially driven. And I do think it's also economically driven. You know, the irony is the GOP loves to talk about the bicoastal elites and how out of touch the bicoastal elites are as Democrats, et cetera. And yet these types of plans through Project 2025 are exactly the exemplars of what they are trying to do to make sure that you keep a certain subgroup of people in our world, that you keep them down below your feet, right? That you put them under your heel, and they do it beginning with education.
It definitely sounds like separate but equal, except we know separate is not equal. By giving the money to people to spend for parochial school education, for private education, and that means that people who are going to take this money, it's not going to cover private schools, but it sure is a big help, and it diminishes the public schools. And I saw that happen in Chicago. Joyce, I was listening to you talk about your mom and what she did, and it reminded me that my husband actually taught in a summer Great Society program to help transition at-risk high schoolers to be able to go to college. And those are things that really make a difference. And I saw it over and over again at the Chicago Public Schools. And I see no reason to abolish the Department of Education. And it doesn't save any money because to the extent they're saying, well, it'll just be block grants. It's the same money just being spent badly. Sorry to say this to you, Joyce, but you know, your state and others surrounding you will not spend it the same way my state will. It probably applies to you too, Katie, in Florida.
Our states will be big offenders.
Yes, exactly. So I think it's a really bad idea if we're going to have the cultural integration that we need to have in this country. People have to go to school together. And like you, Katie, I went, including through college, I went to public schools. It was only at law school that I went to a private school. And I think it's made a big difference in my life. And I think that all children should have the benefit of a good public education. And if you keep the rich people in those schools, they will be better because the rich people will demand it. Although I will also say, based on attending many Board of Education meetings, that so will the people who do not have the same resources. They make wonderful advocates for their children. And I think public education is one of the most important things the federal government can help the states to provide.
You know, can I just put in a last push for public education? I grew up in Los Angeles. I went to public school in Los Angeles. The schools had, really my school was predominantly Asian and Hispanic. There were Black people and white people too. But actually, we were the minority in school. I sort of thought that that was the way the world was supposed to look. You know, my friends were Japanese and Chinese and Korean and Vietnamese. That was very normal for us. And we sort of, you know, benefited from that, right? Like if somebody's grandmother was keeping an eye on you after school, you might get rice balls instead of potato chips and peanut butter and jelly. It's a very natural way for kids to grow up. What worries me so much about this, and Jill, it's a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago. I think, isn't it Louisiana where they've proposed that statute that requires the Ten Commandments to be posted in every classroom, every public classroom? I think this chapter of Project 25, this is about the convergence of education with the end of the First Amendment, you know, privilege against establishment of religion. And this notion that religion, that Christian nationalism, which is not Christianity, right? For people that are paying attention, Christian nationalism is not the views of my good Christian friends. It's this sort of bizarre nationalist ideology that is, you know, pro-white people who all think a certain way. And I fear that what we're doing is really we're putting ourselves on a dangerous path towards whatever you want to call it, populism, authoritarianism. When we read these chapters in Project 2025, there's so much, 900 plus pages. We got to read them separately and individually, but we have to think of how they all work together. It's not a pretty picture.
Absolutely. And if you remember from our discussion about that Louisiana law, it was a very specific version of the Ten Commandments. It is not, you know, many religions have a Ten Commandments, many do not. But even among those that do, they aren't all identical. And this was, I'm imposing my religion on you, period. That was it. And that is the end of separation of church and state.
Well, now it's time for our favorite part of the podcast, where we get to answer questions from our listeners. Every week, y'all make us think. You can tell that Brisby in the background wants us to think. If you've got a question for us, please email us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com, or you can tag us on social media using the hashtag sistersinlaw. And if we don't get to your question during the show, we do as many as we can, but keep an eye on our feeds during the week because we'll answer more of your questions there. Katie, I think our first question this week goes to you. It's from David in Long Beach, California. And David asks this, can a federal or state judge decline a case assignment because of likely security concerns that will impact his safety, the safety of court staff, and his family?
Yeah, so I loved this question because the answer is yes. A judge can decline an assignment. Why? Because a judge is supposed to be a impartial arbiter of the law. And if there is a concern that a certain case is going to create a fear of safety or danger to that judge and or their family, that could militate in a way towards disfavor towards one side or another, you know, and because of that, a judge can decline. I think it's an interesting question. And I appreciated, David, your question, because over time, cases have arisen in different, you know, jurisdictions and in different courts that have been, you know, particularly interesting or you know, involving, for example, the mafia, for example, right? I mean, those cases have been around for a long time, but I do think the dangerous climate that we're living in is not just limited to political climates. I think because there's this allegation by Trump and others that lawfare is being deployed to prosecute cases, I think it creates a dangerous judicial climate. And judges are also people, and judges have families, some of them do. And I think it is okay for a judge to say, because of the nature of this case, I do not think that I can be impartial, which is the number one job, right? That's the number one responsibility for a judge. And I think that that's just an honest assessment by that judge of the lay of the land for that particular case. But you don't see it happening often, because given a few outliers, I think, in our judiciary, most of the judges are fair, who want to make sure that they do the right thing on a daily basis when it comes to any litigant or any case that comes before them. But I do say that the short answer, David, is yes, a judge can decline an assignment, because they are random, by the way. These are random assignments, unless there's a related case and that case has to be in front of that judge. But otherwise, they're randomly assigned to judges and a judge can decline.
Jill, our next question comes from Carol for you. She asks, if President Biden dies in office, Vice President Harris will become president. Who becomes the vice president? Are the Democrats free to appoint someone, or does it go to the House or Senate?
That's a great question, and it comes from the assassination of John F. Kennedy. His vice president, Lyndon Johnson, became president, and he served his term without having a vice president, because there was no mechanism. So shortly after that, in July of 1965, there was a new proposal for a 25th Amendment, which allows under Section 2 that when the office of vice president becomes vacant, either through resignation, as happened when Agnew resigned, so it was used by Nixon, but it actually was the result of Lyndon Johnson serving without a vice president. Nixon then appointed he resigned, his vice president became president, and then he was able to appoint a new vice president with the majority vote of both houses of Congress.
Our last question comes from Plantain Jane on Twitter, and she asks, and this is such a great question, why can Alec Baldwin not be tried again? As many of you know, Alec Baldwin was being charged with involuntary manslaughter in connection with the shooting death of one of the folks involved in filming the movie Rust. That prosecution just ended after it was disclosed that the prosecution had withheld evidence that could have possibly been exculpatory, that could have helped Baldwin establish that he was not guilty. The question is, why can't they just have a new trial now that everybody knows about this evidence? The answer is double jeopardy. Once a jury has been impaneled, we call that jeopardy attaches. Once that jury is in the box and the trial proceeds, a defendant can't be forced back to trial by that same sovereign, which in this case is the state, and you can't face trial a second time after you've been acquitted. So that's where we go with that one. That's a principle we see come up in a lot of cases. Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Winebanks, Katie Fang, and me, Joyce Vance. We are super indebted to Katie Fang for joining us this week. I hope you'll watch her show on MSNBC, The Katie Fang Show, at noon on Saturdays. Remember to mark your calendars. Hashtag Sisters-in-Law will be doing a live show at the 92nd Street Y in New York City on September 20th. You can get tickets at politicon.com/tour. or the 92nd Street Y website. We are really looking forward to seeing folks there. And please show some love to this week's sponsors, HelloFresh, Calm, and One Skin. Their links are in the show notes. Please support them because they make this podcast possible and because we love all of them. Follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and please give us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. See you next week with a new episode. Hashtag Sisters-in-Law. Okay, I just got to register a minor objection here.
Yes.
Whoever wrote into this ad for me that I should talk about dry summer sun, given that I live in Alabama, we're going to have to bring everybody who works on this podcast down to Alabama, because there is nothing dry that goes on down here in summer. I just want that noted. I was like reading that thinking, oh, please, if only we could have dry.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. They aren't affected by tariffs because their clothing products never left the U.S. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.